particular effects are foreseen at the time a law is made, it ceases to be a mere instrument to be used by the people, and becomes instead an instrument used by the lawgiver upon the people, and for his ends. The state ceases to be a piece of utilitarian machinery intended to help individuals in the fullest development of their individual personality, and becomes a moral institution, where moral is not used in contrast to immoral, but describes an institution which imposes on its members its views on all moral questions, whether these views be moral or highly immoral. In this sense, the Nazi or any other collectivist state is moral, while the liberal state is not. Perhaps it will be said that all this raises no serious problem, because in the kind of questions which the economic planner would have to decide, he need not and should not be guided by his individual prejudices, but could rely on the general conviction of what is fair and reasonable. This contention usually receives support from those who have experience of planning in a particular industry, and who find that there is no insuperable difficulty about arriving at a decision which all those immediately interested will accept as fair. The reason why this experience proves nothing is, of course, the selection of the interests concerned when planning is confined to a particular industry. Those most immediately interested in a particular issue are not necessarily the best judges of the interests of society as a whole. To take only the most characteristic case, when capital and labor in an industry agree on some policy of restriction, and thus exploit the consumers, there is usually no difficulty about the division of the spoils in proportion to former earnings, or on some similar principle. The loss, which is divided between thousands or millions, is usually either simply disregarded or quite inadequately considered. If we want to test the usefulness of the principle of fairness in deciding the kind of issues which arise in economic planning, we must apply it to some question where the gains and the losses are seen equally clearly. In such instances, it is readily recognized that no general principle such as fairness can provide an answer. When we have to choose between higher wages for nurses or doctors, and more extensive services for the sick, more milk for children, and better wages for agricultural workers, or between employment for the unemployed or better wages for those already employed, nothing short of a complete system of values in which every want of every person or group has a definite place is necessary to provide an answer. In fact, as planning becomes more and more extensive, it becomes regularly necessary to qualify legal provisions increasingly by reference to what is fair or reasonable. This means that it becomes necessary to leave the decision of the concrete case more and more to the discretion of the judge or authority in question. One could write a history of the decline of the rule of law, the disappearance of the Rechtsstaat, in terms of the progressive introduction of these vague formulas into legislation and jurisdiction, and of the increasing arbitrariness and uncertainty of, and the consequent disrespect for, the law and the judicature, which in these circumstances could not but become an instrument of policy. It is important to point out once more, in this connection, that this process of the decline of the rule of law had been going on steadily in Germany for some time before Hitler came into power, and that a policy well advanced toward totalitarian planning had already done a great deal of the work which Hitler completed. There can be no doubt that planning necessarily involves deliberate discrimination between particular needs of different people, and allowing one man to do what another must be prevented from doing. It must lay down by a legal rule how well off particular people shall be, and what different people are to be allowed to have and do. It means, in effect, a return to the rule of status, a reversal of the movement of progressive societies, which, in the famous phrase of Sir Henry Maine, has hitherto been a movement from status to contract. Indeed, the rule of law, more than the rule of contract, should probably be regarded as the true opposite of the rule of status. It is the rule of law, in the sense of the rule of formal law, the absence of legal privileges of particular people, designated by authority, which safeguards that equality before the law, which is the opposite of arbitrary government. A necessary and only apparently paradoxical, result of this is that formal equality before the law is in conflict, and in fact incompatible, with any activity of the government deliberately aiming at material or substantive equality of different people, and that any policy aiming directly at a substantive ideal of distributive justice must lead to the destruction of the rule of law. To produce the same result for different people, it is necessary to treat them differently. To give different people the same objective opportunities is not to give them the same subjective chance. It cannot be denied that the rule of law produces economic inequality. All that can be claimed for it is that this inequality is not designed to affect particular people in a particular way. It is very significant and characteristic that socialists and Nazis have always protested against merely formal justice, that they have always objected to a law which had no views on how well-off particular people ought to be. It is, therefore, not altogether false when the legal theorist of National Socialism, Carl Schmitt, opposes to the liberal Rechtsstaat, i.e. the rule of law, the National Socialist ideal of the Gerechtsstaat, the just state. Only that the sort of justice which is opposed to formal justice necessarily implies discrimination between persons. And that they have always demanded a socialization of the law, attacked the independence of judges, and at the same time given their support to all such movements as the Freiheitsschule, which undermine the rule of law. It may even be said that for the rule of law to be effective, it is more important that there should be a rule applied always without exceptions than what this rule is. Often the content of the rule is indeed of minor importance, provided the same rule is universally enforced. To revert to a former example, it does not matter whether we all drive on the left or on the right-hand side of the road, so long as we all do the same. The important thing is that the rule enables us to predict other people's behavior correctly, and this requires that it should apply to all cases, even if in a particular instance we feel it to be unjust. The conflict between formal justice and formal equality before the law, on the one hand, and the attempts to realize various ideals of substantive justice and equality, on the other, also accounts for the widespread confusion about the concept of privilege and its consequent abuse. To mention only the most important instance of this abuse, the application of the term privilege to property as such. It would indeed be privilege if, for example, as has sometimes been the case in the past, landed property were reserved to members of the nobility. And it is privilege if, as is true in our time, the right to produce or sell particular things is reserved to particular people designated by authority. But to call private property as such, which all can acquire under the same rules, a privilege, because only some succeed in acquiring it, is depriving the word privilege of its meaning. The unpredictability of the particular effects, which is the distinguishing characteristic of the formal laws of a liberal system, is also important because it helps us to clear up another confusion about the nature of this system, the belief that its characteristic attitude is inaction of the state. The question whether the state should or should not act or interfere poses an altogether false alternative. And the term laissez-faire is a highly ambiguous and misleading description of the principles on which a liberal policy is based. Of course, every state must act and every action of the state interferes with something or other. But that is not the point. The important question is whether the individual can foresee the action of the state and make use of this knowledge as a datum in forming his own plans, with the result that the state cannot control the use made of its machinery and that the individual knows precisely how far he will be protected against interference from others, or whether the state is in a position to frustrate individual efforts. The state controlling weights and measures, or preventing fraud and deception in any other way, is certainly acting, while the state permitting the use of violence, for example, by strike pickets, is inactive. Yet it is in the first case that the state observes liberal principles, and in the second that it does not. Similarly, with respect to most of the general and permanent rules which the state may establish with regard to production, such as building regulations or factory laws, these may be wise or unwise in the particular instance, but they do not conflict with liberal principles so long as they are intended to be permanent and are not used to favor or harm particular people. It is true that in these instances there will, apart from the long-run effects which cannot be predicted, also be short-run effects on particular people which may be clearly known. But with this kind of laws, the short-run effects are in general not, or at least ought not to be, the guiding consideration. As these immediate and predictable effects become more important compared with the long-run effects, we approach the borderline where the distinction, however clear in principle, becomes blurred in practice. The rule of law was consciously evolved only during the liberal age, and is one of its greatest achievements, not only as a safeguard, but as the legal embodiment of freedom. As Immanuel Kant put it, and Voltaire expressed it before him in very much the same terms, man is free if he needs to obey no person but solely the laws. As a vague ideal, it has, however, existed at least since Roman times, and during the last few centuries it has never been so seriously threatened as it is today. The idea that there is no limit to the powers of the legislator is in part a result of popular sovereignty and democratic government. It has been strengthened by the belief that, so long as all actions of the state are duly authorized by legislation, the rule of law will be preserved. But this is completely to misconceive the meaning of the rule of law. This rule has little to do with the question whether all actions of government are legal in the juridical sense. They may well be, and yet not conform to the rule of law. The fact that someone has full legal authority to act in the way he does gives no answer to the question whether the law gives him power to act arbitrarily, or whether the law prescribes unequivocally how he has to act. It may well be that Hitler has obtained his unlimited powers in a strictly constitutional manner, and that whatever he does is therefore legal in the juridical sense. But who would suggest, for that reason, that the rule of law still prevails in Germany? To say that in a planned society the rule of law cannot hold is, therefore, not to say that the actions of the government will not be legal, or that such a society will necessarily be lawless. It means only that the use of the government's coercive powers will no longer be limited and determined by pre-established rules. The law can, and to make a central direction of economic activity possible, must, legalize what to all intents and purposes remains arbitrary action. If the law says that such a board or authority may do what it pleases, anything that board or authority does is legal, but its actions are certainly not subject to the rule of law. By giving the government unlimited powers, the most arbitrary rule can be made legal, and in this way, a democracy may set up the most complete despotism imaginable. The conflict is thus not, as it has often been misconceived in 19th-century discussions, one between liberty and law. As John Locke had already made clear, there can be no liberty without law. The conflict is between different kinds of law, law so different that it should hardly be called by the same name. One is the law of the rule of law, general principles laid down beforehand, the rules of the game, which enable individuals to foresee how the coercive apparatus of the state will be used, or what he and his fellow citizens will be allowed to do or made to do in stated circumstances. The other kind of law gives, in effect, the authority power to do what it thinks fit to do. Thus, the rule of law could clearly not be preserved in a democracy that undertook to decide every conflict of interests, not according to rules previously laid down, but on its merits. If, however, the law is to enable authorities to direct economic life, it must give them powers to make and enforce decisions in circumstances which cannot be foreseen and on principles which cannot be stated in generic form. The consequence is that, as planning extends, the delegation of legislative powers to diverse boards and authorities becomes increasingly common. When, before the last war, in a case to which the late Lord Hewitt has recently drawn attention, Mr. Justice Darling said that Parliament had enacted only last year that the Board of Agriculture, in acting as they did, should be no more impeachable than Parliament itself, this was still a rare thing. It has since become an almost daily occurrence. Constantly, the broadest powers are conferred on new authorities which, without being bound by fixed rules, have almost unlimited discretion in regulating this or that activity of the people. The rule of law thus implies limits to the scope of legislation. It restricts it to the kind of general rules known as formal law, and excludes legislation either directly aimed at particular people or at enabling anybody to use the coercive power of the state for the purpose of such discrimination. It means not that everything is regulated by law, but, on the contrary, that the coercive power of the state can be used only in cases defined in advance by the law, and in such a way that it can be foreseen how it will be used. A particular enactment can thus infringe the rule of law. Anyone ready to deny this would have to contend that whether the rule of law prevails today in Germany, Italy, or Russia depends on whether the dictators have obtained their absolute power by constitutional means. Another illustration of an infringement of the rule of law by legislation is the case of the Bill of Attainder, familiar in the history of England. The form which the rule of law takes in criminal law is usually expressed by the Latin tag nulla poena sine lege, no punishment without a law expressly prescribing it. The essence of this rule is that the law must have existed as a general rule before the individual case arose to which it is to be applied. Nobody would argue that, when in a famous case in Henry VIII's reign, Parliament resolved with respect to the Bishop of Rochester's cook that the said Richard Rose shall be boiled to death without having the advantage of his clergy. This act was performed under the rule of law. But while the rule of law had become an essential part of criminal procedure in all liberal countries, it cannot be preserved in totalitarian regimes. There, as E.B. Ashton has well expressed it, the liberal maxim is replaced by the principles nullum crimen sine poena. No crime must remain without punishment, whether the law explicitly provides for it or not. The rights of the state do not end with punishing lawbreakers. The community is entitled to whatever may seem necessary to the protection of its interests, of which observance of the law, as it stands, is only one of the more elementary requirements. E.B. Ashton, The Fascist, His State and Mind, 1937, page 119. What is an infringement of the interests of the community is, of course, decided by the authorities. Whether, as in some countries, the main applications of the rule of law are laid down in a Bill of Rights or in a constitutional code, or whether the principle is merely a firmly established tradition, matters comparatively little. But it will readily be seen that, whatever form it takes, any such recognized limitations of the powers of legislation imply the recognition of the inalienable right of the individual, inviolable rights of man. It is pathetic but characteristic of the muddle into which many of our intellectuals have been led by the conflicting ideals in which they believe that a leading advocate of the most comprehensive central planning, like H.G. Wells, should at the same time write an ardent defense of the rights of man. The individual rights which Mr. Wells hopes to preserve would inevitably obstruct the planning which he desires. To some extent, he seems to realize the dilemma, and we find, therefore, the provisions of his proposed Declaration of the Rights of Man so hedged about with qualifications that they lose all significance. While, for instance, his declaration proclaims that every man shall have the right to buy and sell without any discriminatory restrictions anything which may be lawfully bought and sold, which is admirable, he immediately proceeds to make the whole provision nugatory by adding that it applies only to buying and selling in such quantities and with such reservations as are compatible with the common welfare. But since, of course, all restrictions ever imposed upon buying or selling anything are supposed to be necessary in the interest of the common welfare, there is really no restriction which this clause effectively prevents, and no right of the individual that is safeguarded by it. Or, to take another basic clause, the Declaration states that every man may engage in any lawful occupation, and that he is entitled to paid employment and to a free choice whenever there is any variety of employment open to him. It is not stated, however, who is to decide whether a particular employment is open to a particular person, and the added provision that he may suggest employment for himself and have his claim publicly considered, accepted, or dismissed shows that Mr. Wells is thinking in terms of an authority which decides whether a man is entitled to a particular position, which certainly means the opposite of free choice of occupation. And how, in a planned world, freedom of travel and migration is to be secured when not only the means of communication and currencies are controlled, but also the location of industries planned, or how the freedom of the press is to be safeguarded when the supply of paper and all the channels of distribution are controlled by the planning authority, are questions to which Mr. Wells provides as little answer as any other planner. In this respect, much more consistency is shown by the more numerous reformers who, ever since the beginning of the socialist movement, have attacked the metaphysical idea of individual rights and insisted that, in a rationally ordered world, there will be no individual rights, but only individual duties. This, indeed, has become the much more common attitude of our so-called progressives, and few things are more certain to expose one to the reproach of being a reactionary than if one protests against a measure on the grounds that it is a violation of the rights of the individual. Even a liberal paper like The Economist was, a few years ago, holding up to us the example of the French, of all people, who had learned the lesson that democratic government, no less than dictatorship, must always, sic, have plenary powers in posse, without sacrificing their democratic and representative character. There is no restrictive penumbra of individual rights that can never be touched by government in administrative matters, whatever the circumstances. There is no limit to the power of ruling which can and should be taken by a government freely chosen by the people and can be fully and openly criticized by an opposition. This may be inevitable in wartime, when, of course, even free and open criticism is necessarily restricted. But the always in the statement quoted does not suggest that The Economist regards it as a regrettable wartime necessity. Yet, as a permanent institution, this view is certainly incompatible with the preservation of the rule of law, and it leads straight to the totalitarian state. It is, however, the view which all those who want the government to direct economic life must hold. How even a formal recognition of individual rights, or of the equal rights of minorities, loses all significance in a state which embarks on a complete control of economic life has been amply demonstrated by the experience of the various Central European countries. It has been shown there that it is possible to pursue a policy of ruthless discrimination against national minorities by the use of recognized instruments of economic policy without ever infringing the letter of the statutory protection of minority rights. This oppression by means of economic policy was greatly facilitated by the fact that particular industries or activities were largely in the hands of a national minority, so that many a measure aimed ostensibly against an industry or class was, in fact, aimed at a national minority. But the almost boundless possibilities for a policy of discrimination and oppression provided by such apparently innocuous principles as government control of the development of industries have been amply demonstrated to all those desirous of seeing how the political consequences of planning appear in practice. Chapter 7. Economic Control and Totalitarianism. The control of the production of wealth is the control of human life itself. Hilaire Belloc. Most planners who have seriously considered the practical aspects of their task have little doubt that a directed economy must be run on more or less dictatorial lines, that the complex system of interrelated activities, if it is to be consciously directed at all, must be directed by a single staff of experts, and that ultimate responsibility and power must rest in the hands of a commander-in-chief whose actions must not be fettered by democratic procedure, is too obvious a consequence of underlying ideas of central planning not to command fairly general assent. The consolation our planners offer us is that this authoritarian direction will apply only to economic matters. One of the most prominent economic planners, Stuart Chase, assures us, for instance, that in a planned society, political democracy can remain if it confines itself to all but economic matter. Such assurances are usually accompanied by the suggestion that, by giving up freedom in what are, or ought to be, the less important aspects of our lives, we shall obtain greater freedom in the pursuit of higher values. On this ground, people who abhor the idea of a political dictatorship often clamor for a dictator in the economic field. The arguments used appeal to our best instincts and often attract the finest minds. If planning really did free us from the less important cares, and so made it easier to render our existence one of plain living and high thinking, who would wish to belittle such an ideal? If our economic activities really concerned only the inferior or even more sordid sides of life, of course we ought to endeavor by all means to find a way to relieve ourselves from the excessive care for material ends, and, leaving them, to be cared for by some piece of utilitarian machinery, set our minds free for the higher things of life. Unfortunately, the assurance people derive from this belief that the power which is exercised over economic life is a power over matters of secondary importance only, and which makes them take lightly the threat to the freedom of our economic pursuits, is altogether unwarranted. It is largely a consequence of the erroneous belief that there are purely economic ends, separate from the other ends of life. Yet, apart from the pathological case of the miser, there is no such thing. The ultimate ends of the activities of reasonable beings are never economic. Strictly speaking, there is no economic motive, but only economic factors conditioning our striving for other ends. What in ordinary language is misleadingly called the economic motive means merely the desire for general opportunity, the desire for power to achieve unspecified ends. Cf. Lionel Robbins, The Economic Causes of War, 1939, Appendix. If we strive for money, it is because it offers us the widest choice in enjoying the fruits of our efforts, because in modern society, it is through the limitation of our money incomes that we are made to feel the restrictions which our relative poverty still imposes upon us, many have come to hate money as the symbol of these restrictions. But this is to mistake for the cause the medium through which a force makes itself felt. It would be much truer to say that money is one of the greatest instruments of freedom ever invented by man. It is money which, in existing society, opens an astounding range of choice to the poor man, a range greater than that which not many generations ago was open to the wealthy. We shall better understand the significance of this service of money if we consider what it would really mean if, as so many socialists characteristically propose, the pecuniary motive were largely displaced by non-economic incentives. If all rewards, instead of being offered in money, were offered in the form of public distinctions or privileges, positions of power over other men, or better housing or better food, opportunities for travel or education, this would merely mean that the recipient would no longer be allowed to choose, and that whoever fixed the reward determined not only its size, but also the particular form in which it should be enjoyed. Once we realize that there is no separate economic motive, and that an economic gain or economic loss is merely a gain or a loss where it is still in our power to decide which of our needs or desires shall be affected, it is also easier to see the important kernel of truth in the general belief that economic matters affect only the less important ends of life, and to understand the contempt in which merely economic considerations are often held. In a sense, this is quite justified in a market economy, but only in such a free economy. So long as we can freely dispose over our income and all our possessions, economic loss will always deprive us only of what we regard as the least important of the desires we were able to satisfy. A merely economic loss is thus one whose effect we can still make fall on our less important needs. While when we say that the value of something we have lost is much greater than its economic value, or that it cannot even be estimated in economic terms, this means that we must bear the loss where it falls. And, similarly, with an economic gain. Economic changes, in other words, usually affect only the fringe, the margin of our needs. There are many things which are more important than anything which economic gains or losses are likely to affect, which, for us, stand high above the amenities and even above many of the necessities of life which are affected by the economic ups and downs. Compared with them, the filthy lucre, The question whether we are economically somewhat worse or better off seems of little importance. This makes many people believe that anything which, like economic planning, affects only our economic interests cannot seriously interfere with the more basic values of life. This, however, is an erroneous conclusion. Economic values are less important to us than many things precisely because in economic matters we are free to decide what to us is more and what less important. Or, as we might say, because in the present society it is we who have to solve the economic problems of our lives. To be controlled in our economic pursuits means to be always controlled unless we declare our specific purpose. Or, since when we declare our specific purpose, we shall also have to get it approved, we should really be controlled in everything. The question raised by economic planning is, therefore, not merely whether we shall be able to satisfy what we regard as our more or less important needs in the way we prefer. It is whether it shall be we who decide what is more and what is less important for us, or whether this is to be decided by the planner. Economic planning would not affect merely those of our marginal needs that we have in mind when we speak contemptuously about the merely economic. It would, in effect, mean that we as individuals should no longer be allowed to decide what we regard as marginal. The authority directing all economic activity would control not merely the part of our lives which is concerned with inferior things. It would control the allocation of the limited means for all our ends. And whoever controls all economic activity controls the means for all our ends and must therefore decide which are to be satisfied and which not. This is really the crux of the matter. Economic control is not merely control of a sector of human life which can be separated from the rest. It is the control of the means for all our ends. And whoever has sole control of the means must also determine which ends are to be served, which values are to be rated higher and which lower. In short, what men should believe and strive for. Central planning means that the economic problem is to be solved by the community instead of by the individual. But this involves that it must also be the community, or rather its representatives, who must decide the relative importance of the different needs. The so-called economic freedom, which the planners promise us, means precisely that we are to be relieved of the necessity of solving our own economic problems, and that the bitter choices which this often involves are to be made for us. Since, under modern conditions, we are for almost everything dependent on means which our fellow men provide, economic planning would involve direction of almost the whole of our life. There is hardly an aspect of it, from our primary needs to our relations with our family and friends, from the nature of our work to the use of our leisure, over which the planner would not exercise his conscious control. The extent of the control over all life that economic control confers is nowhere better illustrated than in the field of foreign exchanges. Nothing would at first seem to affect private life less than a state control of the dealings in foreign exchange, and most people will regard its introduction with complete indifference. Yet the experience of most continental countries has taught thoughtful people to regard this step as the decisive advance on the path to totalitarianism and the suppression of individual liberty. It is, in fact, the complete delivery of the individual to the tyranny of the state, the final suppression of all means of escape, not merely for the rich, but for everybody. Once the individual is no longer free to travel, no longer free to buy foreign books or journals, once all the means of foreign contact can be restricted to those of whom official opinion approves, or for whom it is regarded as necessary, the effective control of opinion is much greater than that ever exercised by any of the absolutist governments of the 17th and 18th centuries. The power of the planner over our private lives would be no less complete if he chose not to exercise it by direct control of our consumption. Although a planned society would probably to some extent employ rationing and similar devices, the power of the planner over our private lives does not depend on this, and would be hardly less effective if the consumer were nominally free to spend his income as he pleased. The source of this power over all consumption, which in a planned society the authority would possess, would be its control over production. Our freedom of choice in a competitive society rests on the fact that if one person refuses to satisfy our wishes, we can turn to another. But if we face a monopolist, we are at his mercy. And an authority directing the whole economic system would be the most powerful monopolist conceivable. While we need probably not be afraid that such an authority would exploit this power in the manner in which a private monopolist would do so, while its purpose would presumably not be the extortion of maximum financial gain, it would have complete power to decide what we are to be given and on what terms. It would not only decide what commodities and services were to be available and in what quantities, it would be able to direct their distribution between districts and groups and could, if it wished, discriminate between persons to any degree it liked. If we remember why planning is advocated by most people, can there be much doubt that this power would be used for the ends of which the authority approves, and to prevent the pursuits of ends which it disapproves? The power conferred by the control of production and prices is almost unlimited. In a competitive society, the prices we have to pay for a thing, the rate at which we can get one thing for another, depend on the quantities of other things of which, by taking one, we deprive the other members of society. This price is not determined by the conscious will of anybody. And if one way of achieving our ends proves too expensive for us, we are free to try other ways. The obstacles in our path are not due to someone's disapproving of our ends, but to the fact that the same means are also wanted elsewhere. In a directed economy, where the authority watches over the ends pursued, it is certain that it would use its powers to assist some ends and to prevent the realization of others. Not our own view, but somebody else's, of what we ought to like or dislike, would determine what we should get. And, since the authority would have the power to thwart any efforts to elude its guidance, it would control what we consume almost as effectively as if it directly told us how to spend our income. Not only in our capacity as consumers, however, and not even mainly in that capacity, would the will of the authority shape and guide our daily lives. It would do so even more in our position as producers. These two aspects of our lives cannot be separated. And as for most of us, the time we spend at our work is a large part of our whole lives, and as our job usually also determines the place where and the people among whom we live, some freedom in choosing our work is, probably, even more important for our happiness than freedom to spend our income during the hours of leisure. No doubt it is true that even in the best of worlds, this freedom will be very limited. Few people ever have an abundance of choice of occupation. But what matters is that we have some choice, that we are not absolutely tied to a particular job which has been chosen for us, or which we may have chosen in the past, and that if one position becomes quite intolerable, or if we set our heart on another, there is almost always a way for the able, some sacrifice at the price of which he may achieve his goal. Nothing makes conditions more unbearable than the knowledge that no effort of ours can change them, and even if we should never have the strength of mind to make the necessary sacrifice, the knowledge that we could escape, if we only strove hard enough, makes many otherwise intolerable positions bearable. This is not to say that in this respect all is for the best in our present world, or has been so in the most liberal past, and that there is not much that could be done to improve the opportunities of choice open to the people. Here, as elsewhere, the state can do a great deal to help the spreading of knowledge and information, and to assist mobility. But the point is that the kind of state action which really would increase opportunity is almost precisely the opposite of the planning which is now generally advocated and practiced. Most planners, it is true, promise that in the new planned world, free choice of occupation will be scrupulously preserved or even increased. But there, they promise more than they can possibly fulfill. If they want to plan, they must control the entry into the different trades and occupations, or the terms of remuneration, or both. In almost all known instances of planning, the establishment of such controls and restrictions was among the first measures taken. If such control were universally practiced and exercised by a single planning authority, one needs little imagination to see what would become of the free choice of occupation promised. The freedom of choice would be purely fictitious, a mere promise to practice no discrimination where, in the nature of the case, discrimination must be practiced, and where all one could hope would be that the selection would be made on what the authority believed to be objective grounds. There would be little difference if the planning authority confined itself to fixing the terms of employment and tried to regulate numbers by adjusting these terms. By prescribing the remuneration, it would no less effectively bar groups of people from entering many trades than by specifically excluding them. A rather plain girl who badly wants to become a saleswoman, a weakly boy who has set his heart on a job where his weakness handicaps him, as well as in general the apparently less able or less suitable, are not necessarily excluded in a competitive society. If they value the position sufficiently, they will frequently be able to get a start by a financial sacrifice, and will later make good through qualities which at first are not so obvious. But when the authority fixes the remunerations for a whole category, and the selection among the candidates is made by an objective test, the strength of their desire for the job will count for very little. The person whose qualifications are not of the standard type, or whose temperament is not of the ordinary kind, will no longer be able to come to special arrangements with an employer whose dispositions will fit in with his special needs. The person who prefers irregular hours, or even a happy-go-lucky existence, with a small and perhaps uncertain income to a regular routine, will no longer have the choice. Conditions will be, without exception, what in some measure they inevitably are in a large organization, or rather worse, because there will be no possibility of escape. We shall no longer be free to be rational or efficient only when and where we think it worthwhile. We shall all have to conform to the standards which the planning authority must fix in order to simplify its task. To make this immense task manageable, it will have to reduce the diversity of human capacities and inclinations to a few categories of readily interchangeable units and deliberately to disregard minor personal differences. Although the professed aim of planning would be that man should cease to be a mere means, in fact, since it would be impossible to take account of the plan of individual likes and dislikes, the individual would more than ever become a mere means, to be used by the authority in the service of such abstractions as the social welfare or the good of the community. That in a competitive society most things can be had at a price, though it is often a cruelly high price we have to pay, is a fact the importance of which can hardly be overrated. The alternative is not, however, complete freedom of choice, but orders and prohibitions which must be obeyed, and, in the last resort, the favor of the mighty. It is significant of the confusion prevailing on all these subjects that it should have become a cause for reproach that in a competitive society almost everything can be had at a price. If the people who protest against having the higher values of life brought into the cash nexus really mean that we should not be allowed to sacrifice our lesser needs in order to preserve the higher values, and that the choice should be made for us, this demand must be regarded as rather peculiar and scarcely testifies to great respect for the dignity of the individual. That life and health, beauty and virtue, honor and peace of mind can often be preserved only at considerable material cost, and that somebody must make the choice is as undeniable as that we all are sometimes not prepared to make the material sacrifices necessary to protect those higher values against all injury. To take only one example, we could, of course, reduce casualties by automobile accidents to zero if we were willing to bear the cost, if in no other way, by abolishing automobiles. And the same is true of thousands of other instances in which we are constantly risking life and health and all the fine values of the spirit, of ourselves and of our fellow men, to further what we at the same time contemptuously describe as our material comfort. Nor can it be otherwise, since all our ends compete for the same means, and we could not strive for anything but these absolute values if they were on no account to be endangered. That people should wish to be relieved of the bitter choice which hard facts often impose upon them is not surprising. But few want to be relieved through having the choice made for them by others. People just wish that the choice should not be necessary at all, and they are only too ready to believe that the choice is not really necessary, that it is imposed upon them merely by the particular economic system under which we live. What they resent is, in truth, that there is an economic problem. In their wishful belief that there is really no longer an economic problem, people have been confirmed by irresponsible talk about potential plenty, which, if it were a fact, would indeed mean that there is no economic problem which makes the choice inevitable. But although this snare has served socialist propaganda under various names as long as socialism has existed, it is still as palpably untrue as it was when it was first used over 100 years ago. In all this time, not one of the many people who have used it has produced a workable plan of how production could be increased so as to abolish, even in Western Europe, what we regard as poverty, not to speak of the world as a whole. The reader may take it that whoever talks about potential plenty is either dishonest or does not know what he is talking about. Yet it is this false hope, as much as anything, which drives us along the road to planning. To justify these strong words, the following conclusions may be quoted at which Colin Clark, one of the best known among the younger economic statisticians, and a man of undoubted progressive views and a strictly scientific outlook, has arrived in his Conditions of Economic Progress, 1940. The oft-repeated phrases about poverty in the midst of plenty and the problems of production having already been solved, if only we understood the problem of distribution, turn out to be the most untruthful of all modern clichés. The underutilization of productive capacity is a question of considerable importance only in the USA. Though in certain years also it has been of some importance in Great Britain, Germany, and France. But for most of the world, it is entirely subsidiary to the more important fact that, with productive resources fully employed, they can produce so little. The age of plenty will still be a long while in coming. If preventable unemployment were eliminated throughout the trade cycle, this would mean a distinct improvement in the standard of living of the population of the USA. But from the standpoint of the world as a whole, it would only make a small contribution towards the much greater problem of raising the real income of the bulk of the world population to anything like a civilized standard. Pages 3 and 4. While the popular movement still profits by this false belief, the claim that a planned economy would produce a substantially larger output than the competitive system is being progressively abandoned by most students of the problem. Even a good many economists with socialist views who have seriously studied the problems of central planning are now content to hope that a planned society will equal the efficiency of a competitive system. They advocate planning no longer because of its superior productivity, but because it will enable us to secure a more just and equitable distribution of wealth. This is, indeed, the only argument for planning which can be seriously pressed. It is indisputable that if we want to secure a distribution of wealth which conforms to some predetermined standard, if we want consciously to decide who is to have what, we must plan the whole economic system. But the question remains whether the price we should have to pay for the realization of somebody's ideal of justice is not bound to be more discontent and more oppression than was ever caused by the much-abused free play of economic forces. We should be seriously deceiving ourselves if, for these apprehensions, we sought comfort in the consideration that the adoption of central planning would merely mean a return, after a brief spell of a free economy, to the ties and regulations which have governed economic activity through most ages, and that, therefore, the infringements of personal liberty need not be greater than they were before the age of laissez-faire. This is a dangerous illusion. Even during the periods of European history when the regimentation of economic life went furthest, it amounted to little more than the creation of a general and semi-permanent framework of rules within which the individual preserved a wide free sphere. The apparatus of control then available would not have been adequate to impose more than very general directions. And even where the control was most complete, it extended only to those activities of a person through which he took part in the social division of labor. In the much wider sphere in which he then still lived on his own products, he was free to act as he chose. The situation is now entirely different. During the liberal era, The progressive division of labor has created a situation where almost every one of our activities is part of a social process. This is a development which we cannot reverse, since it is only because of it that we can maintain the vastly increased population at anything like present standards. But, in consequence, the substitution of central planning for competition would require a central direction of a much greater part of our lives than was ever attempted before. It could not stop at what we regard as our economic activities, because we are now, for almost every part of our lives, dependent on somebody else's economic activities. It is no accident that, in the totalitarian countries, be it Russia or Germany or Italy, the question of how to organize the people's leisure has become a problem of planning. The Germans have even invented for this problem the horrible and self-contradictory name Freizeitgestaltung, literally, the shaping of the use made of the people's free time, as if it were still free time when it has to be spent in the way ordained by authority. The passion for the collective satisfaction of our needs, with which our socialists have so well prepared the way for totalitarianism, and which wants us to take our pleasures as well as our necessities at the appointed time and in the prescribed form, is, of course, partly intended as a means of political education. But it is also the result of the exigencies of planning, which consists essentially in depriving us of choice in order to give us whatever fits best into the plan, and that at a time determined by the plan. It is often said that political freedom is meaningless without economic freedom. This is true enough, but in a sense almost opposite from that in which the phrase is used by our planners. The economic freedom, which is the prerequisite of any other freedom, cannot be the freedom from economic care which the socialists promise us, and which can be obtained only by relieving the individual at the same time of the necessity and of the power of choice. It must be the freedom of our economic activity which, with the right of choice, inevitably also carries the risk and the responsibility of that right. Chapter 8. Who? Whom? The finest opportunity ever given to the world was thrown away because the passion for equality made vain the hope for freedom. Lord Acton. It is significant that one of the commonest objections to competition is that it is blind. It is not irrelevant to recall that, to the ancients, blindness was an attribute of their deity of justice. Although competition and justice may have little else in common, it is as much a commendation of competition as of justice that it is no respecter of persons, that it is impossible to foretell who will be the lucky ones or whom disaster will strike, that rewards and penalties are not shared out according to somebody's views about the merits or demerits of different people, but depend on their capacity and their luck, is as important as that, in framing legal rules, we should not be able to predict which particular person will gain and which will lose by their application. And this is nonetheless true, because in competition, chance and good luck are often as important as skill and foresight in determining the fate of different people. The choice open to us is not between a system in which everybody will get what he deserves according to some absolute and universal standard of right, and one where the individual shares are determined partly by accident or good or ill chance, but between a system where it is the will of a few persons that decides who is to get what, and one where it depends at least partly on the ability and enterprise of the people concerned, and partly on unforeseeable circumstances. This is no less relevant because, in a system of free enterprise, chances are not equal, since such a system is necessarily based on private property and, though perhaps not with the same necessity, on inheritance, with the differences in opportunity which these create. There is, indeed, a strong case for reducing this inequality of opportunity as far as congenital differences permit, and as it is possible to do so without destroying the impersonal character of the process by which everybody has to take his chance, and no person's view about what is right and desirable overrules that of others. The fact that the opportunities open to the poor in a competitive society are much more restricted than those open to the rich does not make it less true that, in such a society, the poor are much more free than a person commanding much greater material comfort in a different type of society. Although under competition, the probability that a man who starts poor will reach great wealth is much smaller than is true of the man who has inherited property, it is not only possible for the former, but the competitive system is the only one where it depends solely on him and not on the favors of the mighty, and where nobody can prevent a man from attempting to achieve this result. It is only because we have forgotten what unfreedom means that we often overlook the patent fact that, in every real sense, a badly paid unskilled worker in this country has more freedom to shape his life than many a small entrepreneur in Germany, or a much better paid engineer or manager in Russia. Whether it is a question of changing his job or the place where he lives, of professing certain views, or of spending his leisure in a particular manner, although sometimes the price he may have to pay for following his inclinations may be high, and to many appear too high, there are no absolute impediments, no dangers to bodily security and freedom, that confine him by brute force to the task and the environment to which a superior has assigned him. That the ideal of justice of most socialists would be satisfied if merely private income from property were abolished, and the differences between the earned incomes of different people remained what they are now, is true. It is probable that we habitually overestimate the extent to which inequality of incomes is mainly caused by income derived from property, and therefore the extent to which the major inequalities would be abolished by abolishing income from property. What little information we have about the distribution of incomes in Soviet Russia does not suggest that the inequalities are substantially smaller there than in a capitalist society. Max Eastman, The End of Socialism in Russia, 1937, pages 30-34, gives some information from official Russian sources which suggests that the difference between the highest and the lowest salaries paid in Russia is of the same order of magnitude, about 50-1, as in the United States, and Leon Trotsky, according to an article quoted by James Burnham, The Managerial Revolution, 1941, page 43, estimated as late as 1939 that the upper 11 or 12% of the Soviet population now receives approximately 50% of the national income. This differentiation is sharper than in the United States, where the upper 10% of the population receives approximately 35% of the national income. What these people forget is that, in transferring all property and the means of production to the state, they put the state in a position whereby its action must, in effect, decide all other incomes. The power thus given to the state, and the demand that the state should use it to plan, means nothing else than that it should use it in full awareness of all these effects. To believe that the power which is thus conferred on the state is merely transferred to it from others is erroneous. It is a power which is newly created, and which, in a competitive society, nobody possesses. So long as property is divided among many owners, none of them acting independently has exclusive power to determine the income and position of particular people. Nobody is tied to any one property owner, except by the fact that he may offer better terms than anybody else. What our generation has forgotten is that the system of private property is the most important guarantee of freedom, not only for those who own property, but scarcely less for those who do not. It is only because the control of the means of production is divided among many people acting independently that nobody has complete power over us, that we as individuals can decide what to do with ourselves. If all the means of production were vested in a single hand, whether it be nominally that of society as a whole or that of a dictator, whoever exercises this control has complete power over us. Who can seriously doubt that a member of a small racial or religious minority will be freer with no property, so long as fellow members of his community have property and are therefore able to employ him, than he would be if private property were abolished and he became owner of a nominal share in the communal property? Or that the power which a multiple millionaire, who may be my neighbor and perhaps my employer, has over me is very much less than that which the smallest fonctionnaire possesses who wields the coercive power of the state, and on whose discretion it depends whether and how I am to be allowed to live or to work. And who will deny that a world in which the wealthy are powerful is still a better world than one in which only the already powerful can acquire wealth? It is pathetic, yet at the same time encouraging, to find as prominent an old communist as Max Eastman rediscovering this truth. It seems